Welcome to Bite Size Dental Marketing. My name is Ian de Jong, and today we are talking to Dr. Christopher Phelps, a general dentist, entrepreneur, and internationally recognized expert in patient reactivation, behavioral economics, and influence marketing. Now, I'd had a lot planned for this episode today, but when we got into Cialdini's six principles of influence, the podcast kind of took on its own legs, and we really got into how these six principles, and now the seventh, which is unity, can be applied in your practice to make small changes that are actually going to make a difference in the new patient acquisition, treatment acceptance, and overall production of your business. Enjoy. So, Dr. Phelps, the first question that I have is one I love to do for all of my guests, because your story to me is just as important as everything that you're going to be sharing with us today, because it gives our listeners an understanding of why did Christopher Phelps choose this journey in dentistry, and not just dentistry, but then go beyond and understand it in ways that many dentists often don't really do. Like, I know you have a background in marketing, and you look at behavioral economics, and of course you went on, you became a dentist, you have the Phelps Institute. That's a long list of things, and I would love if you can just get into where this all started for you.
You know, it all started, flashback, when I was in seventh grade, so in middle school here in the States, and my buddy and I were sitting around his house playing video games. And his mom was tired of us doing that, so she was looking for extracurricular activities to sign him up for. And somehow she found out about a Future Dentist of America club meeting that was going on in our area in Greensboro, North Carolina. And she signed him up for it. And he looks to me one day and he goes, "Hey, my mom signed me up for this dentist thing. Do you want to go?" Because he didn't want to go by himself. And I was like, "Yeah, sure. What am I doing? I'll go with you." So now I'm at this event, and this dentist is taking us around his office. He's doing a traditional carousel slideshow, showing us pictures of smiles and his happy patients and how he takes care of people. And I looked in the corner of his office, and kind of right under a light was a table with all these shiny instruments. Like, they looked brand new. And so, like a moth to a flame, I was kind of drawn to him, like, "Ooh, what's all this stuff?" And he was one of the early implant pioneers doing blade implants. So implants that look like the bottom of a skate, like an ice skate. When you put a tooth on it, kind of thing. And so you would build a drill, basically a trough in the bone, put this blade down in there, and the bone would kind of grow around it. And you'd have a post sticking up to put a tooth on it. And I was just like, "Oh my God, so you do what to people's jaws? Like, you do surgery and use all these instruments?" And he was like, "Yeah, that's what I do." And I was like, for whatever reason, just really drawn to that aspect, that he not only did smiles, he did the surgeries and kind of more complicated things. And I can't explain it, except I had this overpowering feeling in that moment where I was like, "Yeah, this is what I'm going to do when I grow up." And so I literally made the commitment then, and it set me on a path, right? I became a better student because, you know, my mom said, "Well, you know, you got a D in this class right now. You know, you can't go to dental school with D's." And she was like, "Well, lucky for you, they don't count until high school. So figure it out now. So when high school comes, you're ready." And I was like, "Yes, okay, I still got time." So, and I did, right? And I did well. So that kind of set me on the dentistry path. What I hadn't realized was that truly at my core, I'm an entrepreneur that happens to be a good dentist. So I go through school, graduate, join my wife's dentist, who'd been her dentist since she was 15, joined him and bought into his practice in 2003. And what was interesting is we had quite the monumental ride of growth. It was almost like my career at this time was like a tale of two cities. So it started out unbelievable and we couldn't lose. Let's put it that way. So my first year on practice, we doubled the revenue of the practice without increasing the overhead. So as a new owner, that was a great place to be. It allowed me to buy a house and pay down my debt for what I bought in for fairly quickly. It allowed us to build multiple offices. So we did a startup office from scratch. It was probably about 8 miles up the road from the original practice. And same thing, had $1 million in revenue the first year and $2 million in revenue the second year. So just, again, a phenomenal start. So we bought a third office, right? And then we brought on some, we let some of the associates that were with us come in as partners. And then we got a fourth office. And so literally from 2003 to 2010, we 10 times the revenue of the practice.
Was that just the timing was right, the area was right, or were you guys just doing something different that just sparked?
Yeah, here's what we were doing that nobody was doing: marketing. At that time, it was kind of this old boys club where it was negatively viewed upon you if you were marketing. Okay. They were like, the tradition was you just hang a sign with your name on it and hope people will come, or you sign up for an insurance plan and that's how you get your patients. They send them to you, right? We were a true fee-for-service practice for all of our practices. So we weren't in network. So yeah, we weren't getting those people coming to us like all the other docs in town were. So we needed to do something different. And the fact that nobody had marketing in the past and that we might be viewed negatively by our colleagues did not shy me away from doing it anyway. And, you know, I was on the radio, I was doing direct mail, I was doing newspaper inserts, I was in neighborhood newsletters, like as many places as I could put our message, that's where we were, all right? So we benefited from that because it was a time when not many were marketing, if any, right? Mm-hmm. And my colleagues were like, oh no, they're marketing, what's going to happen? Like, they almost thought it was illegal for dentists to market, right? And then they found out, oh geez, they doubled the business. They just added a new location. They added another location. Oh crap, maybe I should market.
Maybe I should start marketing. Yeah.
And the next thing you know, several years later, now everybody's marketing, right? So it was just, I think that was a big catalyst for us. We had a blue ocean. Nobody out there was doing it, and we were the first, right, to do it well and heavily. That catapulted our growth, 10x growth in that 7-year period. And it was great. But then I decided at that point that, you know, to, as one of my mentors calls it, buy back my time, because I had not realized that being the CEO of these four companies, as well as being a clinical dentist, is a major competition for my time. So it became clear that I needed to simplify my life and buy back my time. So me and my original partner decided to take over the two struggling practices, the two worst ones of the bunch. And we sold the two best practices to our other partners, right? So we could kind of consolidate and get back to doing things our way. Well, what's interesting is when you take over your two worst practices is that you don't have the buffer of the good ones to supplement the challenges of the weak ones, right? So one of these practices, now our second cold start office, again, a tale of two cities, meaning the first one we did, the first cold start office, did $1 million the first year, $2 million the second year. We basically tried to replicate that a second time, and this practice is struggling. It's collecting $35,000 a month in revenue with a full-time associate, full-time hygienist, 5 chairs fully ready to go, just like we did the other one. But it's costing us $70,000 a month in expense. So you don't have to be a marketing expert or a business major to realize that's not a good check to write every month, right? When you've got three other practices and three other partners, it's an investment. When you're down to one partner in one practice, that's a problem. So it was a powerful motivator for me to dig into the challenges and not procrastinate on solving them anymore, one of which was in marketing. So our marketing was really successful from the get-go to fuel that growth up until this point. But now I've got these two worst ones, and I'm spending $36,000 a month in marketing to get 60 new patients for my efforts. So 30 at one of my offices and 30 at one of my other offices.
What efforts within that were you doing at that time? Because this was still probably before, I mean, what we know internet marketing as it is today, right?
Right. Yeah, there really weren't. Google AdWords was very basic at most.
Yeah.
So we're talking like 2012, something like
that. So was it mostly, as you said, like the mailers and the banners and the billboards and that type of stuff that was costing that much?
Yeah, radio ads we did with the drive home from work, celebrity crew, if that makes sense. Direct mail, newspaper inserts, any kind of neighborhood magazine, community. There was a lot of community magazines we were in. So a lot of traditional offline external marketing, right? Was really a lot of spending a lot of that money on that. And so I knew that we weren't getting a return for that investment. But I didn't know why. Right. So as you said, that's when I got curious. And now that I had gotten rid of the other practices, I actually had the time to focus on this problem and step out of the chair and go, all right, I can't ignore this anymore. We've got to deal with it. And in my case, I realized that it wasn't the leads not coming in. We had, you know, lots of great leads each month, but my team didn't answer the phone 254 times a month from new patient phone calls. From marketing sources, I paid for the phone to ring and we didn't answer. When they did answer, we only made an appointment 24% of the time with a 17% no-show rate. So then I had to dig into the why of that to kind of turn it around. But flash forward now, maybe 4 months later, on the other side of this, and I'm spending, well, probably 6 months by this point, I'm spending $9,000 a month in total in marketing, and I'm getting 300 fee-for-service patients. So 170 a month at one office and 130 a month at the other office. So night and day difference in that result, right? So that really kind of set me on the path to, I already was doing marketing in the early days, but I can't tell you that I understood marketing, right? It was really studying these pain points and what in the struggling practices that forced me to become an expert in it and figure it out.
Is that what pushed you into this love for behavioral economics and understanding the psychology of marketing in that way? What did you understand about the behavioral economics and these principles that you put out there through your institute that really mattered in that moment to turn things around for the practice?
So getting him in the door is that first and major pain point for most practices, even to this day. But the second one is if they don't come back for treatment, right? It's going to cost you more in marketing to make up for that inefficiency. You know, if you are converting treatment at a 20% rate, then if you want to hit a certain number, you need more people to reach that number. So I realized we had all these pain points with our patient behavior. Why weren't they returning for treatment that they needed with myself and the other doctors that worked for me? I noticed my team struggling here. Why is it that, because I did 2 days at each office, so I would rotate between the two offices. So when I was there at that location, people did their job. If I was not at that location, when the cat was away, the mice would play. And that's what these old adages about human behavior usually speak to, the principles of persuasion behind them, right? Why they stand the test of time. So why do I have to keep telling my team to do their job? Why don't they just do their job? My associate doctors, why am I paying for their education and they don't come back and use the education? They don't create new services that they learn, new things they could charge for with patients, right? So what did I really pay for? So I had all these pain points and behavioral issues going on that I couldn't put my finger on the root cause of why, and which is why nothing happened, right? So when your brain doesn't feel like it understands the root cause, and if it doesn't understand, if it doesn't feel like it has the capabilities to solve the problem, it does two quote unquote helpful things to protect you. Number one, it ignores the problem altogether, right? What problem? There's no problem. Or it procrastinates on the problem. I see it, but I don't have to deal with it now, right? And that's kind of what I was in. I was stuck in that procrastination mode. I didn't know what to do with it. So a friend of mine invited me to a business conference, and Dr. Robert Cialdini was the keynote speaker at that business conference. And at the time, he talked about his six principles of persuasion. We have seven of them now, but back then there were only six. And I remember one of those principles in particular being my light bulb moment, like, aha, that one right there, that one is the root cause behind every one of those pain points. Why aren't the patients coming back for treatment? Why do I have to keep telling my team to do stuff? Why are my doctors implementing the education I paid for, right? I said, all right, this guy knows his stuff. I got to find out more. And then so I immediately got his book, Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion, not realizing the world leaders and experts that had recommended that book. Warren Buffett today still says that's his number one business book on communication. Okay, so I read Influence, digest it, talk about the history and the studies, behavioral science studies. So again, now it's not somebody's opinion on ways to turn things around in your life and your communication. It's science behind it. It's study after study and why people do what they do. So to me, that's more objective. And I like to make strategies around objective things because then they're predictable, right? I can count on them. So I then found out he does a 2-day training once a year in Phoenix, Arizona. So I immediately signed up for that and took my operations manager. And we spent 2 full days with Cialdini and his team learning, going deeper into these things. And then at that event, I found out about their certification program that you can be a train under him directly for over a year and be a certified trainer. And I don't know, I mean, they get thousands of people apply every year, but I threw my name into the hat and said, hey, it never hurts to try. And they selected me, and I got to train with him directly for over a year, get certified in him, and took all this behavioral science research that I learned, and I went back to my two struggling practices and tried to make strategies, not around the excuses people were giving me after they said no, right? So an excuse a patient might say is, you're too expensive, that's why I'm not doing it, or my insurance doesn't cover it. So your strategy to, around the excuse is, well, if it's too expensive, I got to discount it. If it's because of the insurance, I guess I have to take the insurance or get in network, right? Well, I realized that's not actually what the reason was behind their decision. It was these other things leading up to that moment beforehand. That's where we really dropped the ball. So when I implemented these principles and created systems in the patient experience process leading up to the ask, suddenly treatment acceptance blew through the roof for everybody in, right? And within 3 years' time of me selling the two best ones and taking over the two worst ones, between fixing the marketing, pumping in an unlimited quantity of quality due patients, and more people come back doing something with treatment instead of choosing to do nothing, well, we had $1 million growth at each of those clinics, okay, 3 years in a row. And by that time, that means the two clinics were doing more in revenue, profitability, and my free time than when I had four in total. Okay. All because of figuring out the marketing and figuring out the psychology of why people do what they do and making some small changes in how we presented things that resulted in big results.
There's so much I can unpack there. Even as I just listened, I was thinking about so many dentists saying, I want my time back. I don't want to work Fridays. I want to do the higher cases, and I want to not have all of these insurance patients coming in. I'm tired of working so hard and I'm not seeing the bottom line. And you just painted a case study that you went through. This is your case study of, it is possible to love dentistry, to love going into work, to make the money you want to make, but there's certain sacrifices and certain changes that need to happen. So the one that you said now is marketing is a no-brainer. Was that one for you? You said the six principles. Can you take us through those principles so that we can actually make dentists aware of these are the things that you should be thinking about?
Yeah. So the first principle is the principle of reciprocity, which basically states that if someone has given you a gift of value and significance to you, an obligation is created inside of you to give back to them in kind. So example, somebody gives you a gift on your birthday, you're more likely to give them a gift on their birthday. Somebody does you a favor, you're likely now to do them a favor in return, right? So reciprocity is you feel indebted to that person because of this gift. That's the obligation. Therefore, it goes on your to-do list to give back in kind. Liking is based as a simple principle. Dale Carnegie wrote a whole book on how to amplify this principle. But at its core, liking is we like to do business with people we like. Okay, if it's a friend asking, it's hard to say no. If it's an enemy asking, it's easy to say no, right? Meaning a non-friend. So, but true liking is about not trying to get others to like you. It's showing them that you like them first. Okay. If you're the first to show them that you like them, then the reciprocity principle kicks in and they like you back. So how do we show them that we like them? Well, we like those who are like us and take the time to discover that they are like us. Meaning we like people with commonality, similarity, common interests. Okay.
I can hear Dale Carnegie's from How to Win Friends and Influence People. We're reading that as an agency now. And as you're saying that, it's about having real interest in other people, finding similarities. And in that way, the more you are interested in them, the more they will like you. It's as simple as that.
So leveraging that, finding that commonality with them before you get down to the business of dentistry, whatever they're there for, automatically means more people say yes to something that you presented to them versus choosing. Do the worst thing, which is choosing to do nothing. Social proof is another principle. That principle basically states that oftentimes we look to the evidence of what others are doing or have done to show us what we should do. So for instance, if you were walking into a building for the first time and 50 people run out of that building screaming in terror and running in the opposite direction of you, the odds are pretty good you're not going to go into that building to find out what they're running from, right? you just figured out in that moment, oh, this might be a dangerous situation. I should probably go with the crowd. Okay. This is a reason in the animal kingdom that birds flock together, animals herd, fish school. So we have learned evolutionarily that there's safety in the crowd. Okay. We as humans, even though we're more evolved thinkers, so to speak, we are still susceptible to that pull. So yes, we want to be unique individuals, different than everybody else, but we want to be unique individuals that are still part of a tribe, part of a group, part of a community in some aspect. So if we associate ourselves with others and we see them moving a certain direction, there's going to be a pull for you to go the same way. Okay. So if I've seen, you know, I'm at dinner at a restaurant and the waiter says, here's our specials and our most popular dish is, kind of relaying evidence of what the majority have done before me. Studies show that increases acceptance of that item by over 24%. Again, we can leverage the same thing. If you're presenting something that the majority of your patients have actually chosen, don't hide that fact. Lead with it. Let them know this is what the majority of my patients have chosen. If you can put a number to it specifically, this is what 96.7% of my patients have chosen. It sharpens the effect even more, right? So social proof is powerful information to get people to move. The authority principle fits us well, but basically the authority principle states that we look to credible, trustworthy experts to tell us what we should do. So credible means you have to have some kind of expertise and training and experience in the matter and be somebody people can trust. That's really what we're looking for. An expert we can trust. We look to those people to tell us what we should do because truthfully, we don't have time to be an expert in everything. Doesn't mean we can't be an expert. We just physically don't have time. So if I've got a plumber that comes to my house and they tell me I need a new toilet, okay, I don't know anything about plumbing. They got good reviews, people trust them. I guess I'm buying a new toilet, right? So that's all that is. Someone with more expertise in the matter than you, that can be trusted. We look to those folks to tell us what we should do. We have some authority built into us just because of our title, doctor. Patients know, and they're going to take our advice more to heart than even our team members because we have that title. To them, that means we have training, we have expertise as a result. Okay. So authority is a big one. Consistency. Consistency was the principle, my kind of light bulb moment, if you will, that I mentioned earlier. But at its core, simply put, consistency is about commitments. If you get people to commit, then they do. Okay. If you get people to commit, they usually follow through with the commitment that they made and do it. So if you're not seeing the results like I wasn't, what's missing? I realized I wasn't getting a commitment out of any of those people to do any of those things. That was my harsh reality. Once I realized that and I made a point to get better commitments out of my patients to do their treatment, my team to do their job, my doctors to get education they're actually going to come back and use, everything changed. Okay. So consistency is probably one of the most powerful of the principles. If people commit, they do. If they're not doing, you're not getting them to commit at its core. Scarcity. Scarcity means it's really about resources. Okay. So if resources are dwindling or about to run out, then it motivates you to want that thing more and do more to get it. Even if you didn't want it to start with. So we see that effect all the time. If there's like a storm coming into town, a big storm that they broadcast over the news and whatnot, there's a run on bread and milk at the stores, historically. Economics, the law of supply and demand is scarcity at its core. FOMO is scarcity at its core, okay? So if I told you the oxygen was running out of the room you're sitting in right now, most of you would probably want to know that before it runs out versus when it runs out. Because if you know before it runs out, what's it going to motivate you to do? That's where scarcity pulls us, okay? So if things are limited or about to run out, it motivates you to want that thing more and do more to get it. And then the seventh principle, which is the newest principle, which came out in the book Persuasion about eight years ago, I think, is called unity, okay? Unity. So unity is... it's not a you versus me situation. It's a we situation. So sometimes we unite ourselves with others under a banner, under a category of things, something that we uber associate ourselves with. And if we find somebody else associates in the same way, it takes it beyond liking. Liking is, we have a commonality. Let's say Ian and I, let's say we're both from the same hometown. Okay. We're both born in the same place. That's similarity. That's liking, right? But if you absolutely love that town, you're like the poster child for that town, always talking about it, love everything about it. And I hate that town and couldn't get out of there fast enough. Do you see how the similarity stops right there? Versus if we both love that town and unite ourselves under that banner, we are this town. That's unity.
That's sports teams.
Sports. Yeah. Sports teams can create unity. Your family is a unity kind of unit. Culture, religion, geography, there's all kinds of things we can unite under from this. But if somebody is asking you a request and they're united with you, it's hard to say no. Okay. So unity is the seventh principle.
I'll summarize quickly again. It's reciprocity and then commitment and consistency, social proof, authority, liking, scarcity. And then the last one that you said, the seventh one that's been added, is unity. You touched on it briefly, but I want to break down for dentists now. We understand these principles now. Within a dental practice, what does this actually mean to me? When you say reciprocity in my dental office, what does that mean to me? You said that consistency really hit a note and changed things for you. So is it fine with you if we break it down just in terms of examples so that we can relate it back to within the dental practice?
Yeah, definitely. So reciprocity, for instance, how do you know if you've given someone a gift of value and significance to them? Well, there's usually two key words people say to let you know that's happened. And they generally go out of their way to say, thank you. So when somebody thanks you generally for something you or your team have done, if they go out of their way to praise or compliment you for something that you have done, whether you realize it or not, and even if it meant nothing to you and they just paid you for it, if they're bringing it up, you're in a reciprocity moment. They feel obligated to give back. Okay. If a patient sits up from their chair and goes, oh my God, doc, I didn't feel that shot. You're amazing. I can't believe we're done already. That was fast. You didn't hurt me. That's a reciprocity moment. Okay. So if you ask for something in that moment, you're likely to get a yes to it. So one of my favorite things, we're giving these gifts away to patients all day long because they're complimenting and praising us, but we're bungling it by not seeing it as a moment of power that we could ask for something in that moment if we wanted to. So my favorite thing to ask that moment is, hey, my pleasure. I'm so glad you had a great experience. Would you mind helping us out by doing a 5-star Google review? Sharing that story on Google will help not only us, but help others who need a good dentist. And they say yes. Now you got a commitment for them to do the review.
And then they feel the pressure on them eventually. So they are more likely to do it because they want to be a good person. They want to reciprocate what you have done for them.
Yes. You have allowed them to scratch off this obligation off their to-do list. Oh, great. I feel indebted. I got to do something for Ian. You are amazing. Oh, I can do this review? Scratch it off my list.
Right. Okay. And you're saying that dentists don't take that opportunity enough where the signal is there that there's a moment for reciprocity, but we let it go. So therefore we miss out on the patient referral. We miss out on that review. We miss out on the testimonial.
Yes. And In fact, we not only do we miss out on it, we often completely bungle it, us and our teams, by saying two other words that stomp it to death.
Oh, no.
The two words we usually say are, no problem.
Yeah.
Well, number one, technically, you're not being ethically true in saying that if you put any level of effort or energy into making that experience happen, okay? But society has taught us, conditioned us, that we're supposed to say that. I'm telling you, that's crap. The two words that should not be spoken in any culture, religion, continent you grew up in is no problem, okay? So I have a problem with no problem. So at a minimum, because basically what you're doing is this person is trying to give back to you and you're spitting in their face, telling them it meant nothing to you. You devalue them completely in their effort.
I haven't even thought about it. So give patients the opportunity to give back when you as a dentist or your team has done good work. Give them that opportunity.
At a minimum, don't downplay it and spit on it by saying no problem. Just acknowledge it. You're welcome. My pleasure. I was happy to do it. But if you're smart, see it for what it is. If there is something you could ask for, a review, a referral, schedule their next treatment, now's the time to do it.
That makes a lot of sense. The second one, Doc, is commitment and consistency.
Yeah. So one of the best commitments you can get out of people is what we call a verbal commitment, a verbal active commitment. So in one study in a popular restaurant in Chicago, they had a 30% no-show rate on reservations. So it wasn't the authority. This place was had awards like you wouldn't believe. It wasn't the social proof. It was popular. But they still had a 30% no-show rate on reservations. The average no-show rate in dentistry ranges from 17% to 24%. Okay. So we're not too far off. Now, what they did was normally they would make a reservation and they would end the call saying something very similar to what we should do in dentistry. Hey, thanks for making this reservation. Please call us if your plans change and you can't make it. Click, and they hang up the phone. So they ended up with a statement. Well, what if we turned that around and made that an active verbal commitment question instead? Okay, Ian, I got you down for this Saturday at 6 p.m. Ian, will you please call me and let me know if you need to cancel or change your reservation? And you wait for them to commit and say yes, or hopefully they say yes. Yes, I'll do that. Great. Then I got you down. We look forward to seeing you Saturday. So just getting that one verbal commitment, will you please do this? No-show rates drop from 30% to 10% at that restaurant.
Wow. And that is that again by behavioral economics, as you put, or psychology, you put it back to them as, we'll do it because I said I would do it. So therefore it is now on me. Is that, I understand that correctly?
It is. Just because they made an appointment doesn't mean they actually committed to it. What this does is it really creates more of a commitment inside of them and reinforce the fact they said they were going to do this. Or at a minimum, at least call you if they can't make it, which is really all I was trying to influence with my patients. If they can't make it, as long as I have notice, we've got a system for that, right? But if they no-show on us completely, then everybody loses in that scenario, okay? So not only it's going to influence more people to do what they're supposed to and show up, okay? This is just one of many more commitments I got on the telephone from patients, and it helped me drop my no-show rate from 17% to 3%. And it was all about getting better commitments on the telephone and at the chair when we made their appointments.
I know of so many dentists that struggle with this, and we've gone to a point where we introduce like a fee at this, like especially for high-end treatment, where to reserve your appointment, $50 and stuff. But you did this without even introducing a fee, which is that is amazing to me. So you said it's literally just saying, do you commit to the fact that if you cannot show up, you will give us a call? We do not say the practice is going to call them. We put it on them.
Yep.
And that changed it?
That's just one of many things I put in there. So there's active commitments. Verbal is one of those. When people tell you they're going to do stuff, that's an active commitment. There's voluntary commitments. People need to feel like they have a choice in the matter. So we don't just say, Ian, can we see you this Tuesday at 2? No, I can't do that. How about this Thursday at 4? No, I can't do that. How about Wednesday at 3? Okay, I guess I can do that. Now, you think you gave people choices, but when you dictated to them one at a time, you didn't give them a choice. And if people don't feel like they have a choice in the matter, they're not really committing to it.
You gave them options, not a choice.
Exactly. Well, even options is a choice, but you didn't. You gave them one thing.
Oh, yeah.
And they said no. And then you gave them another one thing, and they said no. So in essence, every time you do that, they actually feel more intimidated, they feel like you're backing them into a corner, right?
I see.
Eventually, they will say yes just to get you to shut up. But it doesn't mean they're actually committed to it. Versus if I said, Ian, what works best for you, next week or this week? This week. Okay. Beginning of the week or end of the week? Beginning of the week. Okay. Monday or Wednesday? Wednesday. Morning or afternoon? Afternoon. 2 o'clock or 4 o'clock? 2 o'clock. Great. Looks like I have you down this Wednesday at 2. So when you present things as a this or that choice, that's a true choice. Every time they choose, they're making a voluntary commitment at every step. Now that person is more in control and they're more likely to show to the appointment they now chose, not the one you dictated and told them.
As you're saying this, I just think of this in literally every social setting or any, whether it's marriage, whether it's with a friend, whether it's whatever. It becomes so clear when you say this, nobody's going to do something that they don't want to do. You can't force someone to do something. And I'm sure this psychology plays into what you just said. allowing someone to make the choice by themselves will make them feel, I did that. This was me. So therefore, they are more likely to actually do it. Social proof was the next one that you spoke about.
So again, we look to others to show us what we should do. So in an advertising world, I like to group four testimonials together. Because what most studies show is if you can show four people have moved your direction, said yes to this thing, whatever that is, it'll start the wave at a football or baseball game. Four will influence four more, will influence eight more, et cetera. So you show people, wow, they've got four people that have said something great about them. But at the same time, if you put under there, and to read the 750 plus reviews we have on Google, Facebook, Yelp, and Health Grades on our website, right? Show them how many reviews you have in total. Oh my God. Wow. Not only did these four say something great about them, and look how many people those are, but look how many more they have. 700 people? I'm looking at these other dental ads and they don't have anything positive from patients on there. And they've got over 700. Which one might I choose now? Which one's going to be safer for me? Less risk? The one all these people said something positive about, right?
And is it a risk in the psychology that you've looked at now for people? Is it, I know there's desire to of, I want to see that dentist because it's the best review. Is there risk aversion type of style of thinking when they are like doing what you said now? Oh, this one's 5 stars with 7. Oh, but this one has 2,000 reviews and therefore that it must be better because it's less risk. Is that part of the equation?
Yeah, it's definitely a safety, security, and it's really more about uncertainty more than anything else. They literally just don't know what to choose, which path to go down, what's going to be the best choice for them, right? So some of that's some risk aversion, some of that's the benefit combined, but ultimately it's just which path is going to be more certain versus which is less certain. And if we see evidence that many others have gone down this path, well, maybe I'll be safe going down that path too. That's ultimately what it comes to. So if you're presenting treatment to a patient and you don't show them evidence that you've done this work on your other patients, this is where before and after photos comes into play. Showing them examples that you've done this on many people shows that potential patient in the chair who's going, wow, okay, you've done a lot of work in this area. You must know what you're doing here. Like, look how many people you've served. Versus if you're not showing them evidence you've done this on anybody, what they're thinking is, wait a minute, am I the first to do this? Because nobody likes to be the first. That creates a seed of doubt and uncertainty in their mind. And again, they're not going to choose to do anything as a result. So getting more reviews, sharing all those reviews you have, showing evidence as many before and afters as you can with those that have done that are some of the best ways to leverage social proof.
The next one we're hopping to is authority. So you touched on that briefly with that's just dentists, doctors need to use that authority within the practice for what it is worth. Did I understand that correctly and the influence it can have?
Yeah. So authority is not about telling people you're the authority or the expert. It's about letting other people, other items, other things present you as the authority that you are. And putting up authority triggers to reinforce that. Like for instance, now I'm in my 22nd year of clinical practice. So if a new patient's walking up to my practice for the first time and they see a logo or a badge on my door that says, 20 plus years serving this community, right? That automatically shows I've been around for a while. I might know what I'm talking about. I might have some experience here, right? So it's things that highlight your credentials, if you will. So putting up my diplomas on the wall, my awards, my certificates, those are all authority triggers that show those folks that this is not my first rodeo. I may know what I'm talking about here. So therefore, they're going to take my recommendations more to heart as that expert. Sharing that testimonial, as I mentioned, a review or testimonial, each of those individually actually speaks to your authority. It's actually a patient saying that they trust you because we need experts, but that we can trust. So a single review or testimonial speaks to your authority. It's somebody said they trusted you. But having four more of those as the social proof, it's look how many people trust you. It's a multiple, right? It's not just a singular thing. So it's about getting other things, other items, other ways to present your credentials to the patients without you having to tell them and figuring out ways to build trust.
Your staff probably plays a big role in this too when they're before the patient actually gets to your office and their ability, as you said, to have Oh, have you met Dr. Is this the first time seeing Dr. Fowles? Oh, he has seen so many patients and they just love him. That so would you say that's to your team's role in forking kind of forking up that confidence in that person to say, okay, I'm so happy that I'm seeing Dr. Phelps because this is my guy.
Definitely. That goes back to let other people present your expertise and credentials to the patient so it's not you giving it to them. I definitely love team members introducing you to the patient and endorsing you to the patient before the introduction, before that handoff. And I really like it when my team gets introduced and endorsed, especially if they're going to make some kind of recommendation as well that I'm going to reinforce, right, and back up. Because now it helps us with multiple experts advising us, right? And the more authorities telling us we need this done, the more likely we are to do it. It's one of the reasons why I like AI programs, like, there's DynaCAD and Overjet and Pearl are some really good programs. So patients see these AI programs that review their x-rays and spit out, show you all of the decay and stuff, right? The bone loss and whatever, and point that out to them. It's almost like another authority in their mind, an unbiased source going, oh crap, I got a problem. And now the doctor comes in almost now as the second opinion, and they take their advice more to heart. They're more likely to say yes as a result. Okay. So we got to leverage technology and tools and find other things and ways to promote our expertise and build trust with patients. Liking, as we mentioned before, is just before I get down to the business at hand, my goal is to find at least one thing in common with that person at a minimum. The more, the better, but at least one thing. The hack here is, the trick is that I get my team to find my connection for me. So my team knows everything. I've shared with my team everything I feel comfortable talking about, my hobbies, my interests, my kids, my animals, my whatever, right? So now they're the ones coming to me after interviewing the patient. They spend the time with them and go, hey, Dr. Phelps, Mrs. Jones is in room two. She plays tennis like you do and has two kids. Great. So now I come into the room. My team has endorsed me. They introduce me. And I'll say, hey, Mrs. Jones, I hear you got two kids. I got two kids. Tell me about your kids. Here's my kids. Hey, you play tennis? I play tennis. Let's talk about tennis for a minute. So I can go right to the connection, talk about that for 2 to 5 minutes. And now we can get down to the business of why they're here. And I've automatically built a bridge with this person that wasn't there.
It sounds so simple when you say it like this. And I know probably dentists, they don't do this. It's
They
such a
don't.
small, it's such a small step though.
Yeah. We call these small bigs, small things you can do that can have a big change in your outcomes. And the liking principle is probably the most bungled and ignored by dental offices and truly many companies alike. It's such an easy thing to do, but nobody has time, or so they think. But how much is it costing you by not doing this? We'll turn on scarcity, right? What are you losing out on by not doing this? There's a lot.
A lot. And so scarcity again is that you mentioned it in this way too. Now, on the scarcity side, does it also play in for you on how marketing is presented? We have a limited amount of spots in our seats when we're on the phones talking to someone. How do we implement that in the office too?
Yeah, that's a great way. If you do have limited spots, share that with people. Usually, like if I'm going on vacation this summer, like I'm going out of town, I'll be gone for 10 days with the family. I'm not going to hide that information from my patients. I'm going to share it with them 3 weeks earlier and say, FYI, the office is going to be closed for 10 days next month. We have limited days and appointments available between now and then. If you think you might have an issue or one brewing, give us a call if you want to be seen before we're closed. And if I share that with them early enough that we're the scarce resource, we're going to be not available for 10 days, then what will actually happen is it will motivate people, especially those sitting on the fence. They're like, well, doc did tell me I had that issue. And knowing my luck, guess when it's going to blow up? When they're closed and out of town.
Yeah.
Shoot, I better get in there now. It's going to motivate those that their real problem wasn't the relationship with us. It wasn't that they didn't think they needed the thing. It was they thought they had time. It was the urgency of it. So scarcity motivates people to act because of that. So they don't wait. So it'll actually motivate more people to come in between now and when you're actually closed. You'll actually do more dentistry because of it, more production, more collections. And you'll basically make up what you're going to miss out on by being closed.
But communicate and make sure
share that with people early enough in the process to make that happen.
Then the last one, Dr. Phelps, is unity that you mentioned that was added later on. When I think of that, when you mentioned it earlier, is that the brand that I put out into the world of the type of office that I am? Is it that patients fall in love with me because of who I am? What does unity mean for you here in your everyday dental office and how they can get that right?
Think of it like unitizing language. We, us, our partnership together, right? Unity is just that. It's not you versus me anymore. It's we. We are on the same team. So getting them to associate themselves with you as a whole, we, this office kind of thing, is key. So that's one of the ways you can leverage this is just use that unitizing language. So it's not, Mrs. Jones, how are you going to get this done? It's, Mrs. Jones, let's take some time to figure out how we're going to get this done together.
Co-diagnosis, I'm familiar with, I've spoken to Dr. Paul Henney and Dr. Paul Homley on this, where they said the importance of you are taking that patient on that journey with them. You are elevating their understanding, but it's being made together. This is us making this decision. It's not me telling you, you need or you must get this. It is, here is what I say and you decide. So, okay, that's interesting. Now, Doc, I know I said to you when we started this that we have so much to talk about, and I see that we're close to the hour mark, and I know you're a busy man. I wanted to get into patient reactivation and marketing a bit more, but can I get your commitment to come back on Bite-Sized Dental Marketing, please, so that we can talk about those things again?
Yes, I'm happy to come back and we can continue the conversation.
Oh, thank you, because this was phenomenal, and I'm really happy that we got into the six and our seven principles, because as I said to you, these are things that so many dentists, and you see this every day, that so many dentists struggles with. But if it's just these small changes that they make every day, you saw it in your practice, it compounds, it changes things to a point. So dentists, listen to this today. Go out there, go make these changes. Even if it seems small, do it, because Dr. Christopher Phelps is living proof that making these changes and implementing it really does make a difference at the end of the day. Dr. Phelps, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you having.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.